everyone. Welcome back or welcome to the Human Condition podcast. It's been quite a while, but I'm glad to be back having a discussion about something that has piqued my interest lately, thanks to the rapid developments in the fields of artificial intelligence and artificial general intelligence. As humans, we are inveterate risk takers. The pursuit of human intellect and in turn human excellence has been a part of the human condition for a long, long time. But this time it feels different, partly because the entity we are trying to empower is not entirely understood by us, and also because it feels like we are on the verge of a paradigm-shifting technological leap. It's exciting on the one hand because it promises to unlock unprecedented opportunities for scientific discovery, technological opportunities, and socio-economic progress. But on the other hand, it also raises profound ethical and existential challenges that we need to navigate very carefully as we come to terms with the coexistence of humans alongside these advanced intelligent machines that may ultimately surpass our own cognitive capacities. I'm very glad to be talking to two doctoral students who are pursuing their PhDs in fields related to artificial intelligence, one of whom is a dear friend of mine. Suraj and I have been friends for over a decade now, and we've always had intellectually stimulating conversations, and I'm looking forward to another fun and interesting conversation. Chinmay and I have met only once before, but I'm really excited to be talking to you today. So welcome, and please introduce yourselves, what you're working on, and you can briefly talk about what ideas or concepts interest you when it comes to artificial intelligence. So yeah, Suraj, you can go first.
Yeah, thanks for introducing me, Ravi. So as Ravi mentioned, I'm a PhD student, I'm a second year candidate, and I'm working mostly on AI applications specific to radiology and radiation oncology. And this lies in part of medicine. And I've always been passionate about medicine and how we can try to improve the quality of human life through medicine. Because I was born and brought up in a family of doctors, and seeing them kind of dedicated to patient care and improving the quality of life of people kind of inspired me to get into that field as well. But it kind of really did not appeal to me to actually be as a practicing medical doctor, because I'd seen their lives and they were quite difficult. And it's quite challenging, the kind of toll it takes on you to be constantly engaged in providing the best quality patient care. And especially in a country like India, where the volume of patients is so high and the volume of cases you see as a doctor is so high, it is especially mentally taxing. And I always had an interest for technology and computers. That's something I immediately connected with from a very young age. As soon as I had a computer, I already started loving it, and that's where I really thought I should apply my efforts and my focus to. And I thought, I've seen this problem with my parents, right? My family, they have such a huge volume of cases to deal with, and that affects them personally. And I can imagine that this is the case for doctors in developing countries all across the world, and also in developed countries. You can still improve the quality of care through technology. When I found out about AI, I thought, oh wow, this is such an amazing way to kind of provide support to medicine and various other fields where you can kind of try to replicate human thought process and human ideas, and then apply them to this particular field to reduce the burden on, doctors or other people involved in these fields. That's a bit about why I chose to work in AI in medicine. And apart from just working in this field, I'm also very interested in, the ethical applications of AI and, how AI is, how AI has come to be in its current phase, how it models consciousness similar to what humans might have, and where it can lead us, how it can improve quality of life for us specifically, to improve the quality of life for all of us. I think that's what I'm interested in.
Thanks for introducing me, Ravi. My name is Chinmay. I'm doing my PhD at Leiden University here in the Netherlands. So my topic is mostly focused on computational MRI. Yeah, so I apply AI techniques to problems in physics, for example, to speed up MRI scanning or to simplify and make simulations more efficient. So these are the problems that I'm currently working on. I worked with Suraj in the past during my master's as part of my internship for an year. We studied together for 2 years. And yeah, from there, I also got interested in medical imaging, specifically the applications of AI in medical imaging. But then after our master's, our paths diverged. So I moved more into super technical mathematical, try to focus on the more mathematical aspect of this this field, which is very relevant in an imaging technique like MRI, which has a lot of physics influences. On the side, I've always been interested in things like robotics. Well, more or less from my childhood. I've recently also been having, I've been taking interest in creative AI. So how can you use AI techniques to be creative yourself, or and how can you build an AI system that is creative by itself? I've always also been interested in philosophy, though I don't really have a background in that. But I do like to read a lot on certain fields in epistemology and yeah. And of course, I've also been really interested in science fiction, which is really a treasure trove of ideas for experts and amateurs alike. Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting overlapping domains that all three of us are interested in. Of course, myself, I'm more interested in the philosophical aspect of artificial intelligence and what it means for theories of consciousness and stuff like that. But again, like Chinmay, he's been working on these imaging techniques. I guess things like fMRI techniques and fMRI imaging, all these things have a lot to deal with getting coming up with a scientific framework for theory of consciousness. I think that's, again, something that we can talk about and going ahead. But yeah, it's interesting that we have overlapping perspectives through different lenses, I would say. So to start off, I want to talk about different things today, such as the future of AI, the ethical implications, consciousness. But let's just start with artificial general intelligence, because this is a term that I've been personally hearing a lot more recently. I was not very familiar with the term AGI before. But yeah, even before you do that, how would you define intelligence? And then can you talk about what artificial general intelligence is and how it differs from other kinds of artificial intelligence? Either one of you, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some very interesting theories on what intelligence might actually be. And, you know, one of the main reasons I also thought Chinmay would be a very interesting... So, I mean, we know each other for a while, Ravi, but yeah, I thought Chinmay would be a very interesting person to have on this podcast as well, because that has been the crux of a lot of our discussions. Like, what actually is intelligence? You know, how do we define intelligence? How do we quantify intelligence? How do we, you know, analyze intelligence? Because we're working in the field of artificial intelligence, the term itself being intelligence, as much as we might like it or not, you know, so this, how this term came about, AI, I think it was sometime in the 1920s or so. And yeah, the term artificial intelligence was coined as, you know, by this person who, you know, didn't want to use the term cybernetics because it sounded too impersonal, and then wanted to have something more that connects with, let's say, the human condition, and then call it artificial intelligence. And yes, we wanted to find out, or, you know, we rather wanted to discuss and have this a discourse about what intelligence might actually be, and, you know, how we can kind of try to see if what the work we're doing, you know, kind of measures up to this intelligence. So one of the interesting perspectives, maybe Chinmay can elaborate this on this a bit more, because he's, you know, a lot more familiar with this. So one of the very interesting perspectives that we spoke about is that intelligence is compression in a very basic sense, that, you know, you take a lot of domains of information, you take very dense information, and then you're able to compress it in a very meaningful and efficient way. So, for example, you know, you take a person who's an expert in a field, you know, they have decades of experience in that field, and then they're able to compress it in a very meaningful way. And given any problem or any question or any sort of evaluation of their ability, they're able to give you a very appropriate, concise, and meaningful answer to this. And, you know, this has taken decades of experience for them, right? They've kind of learned this over decades, over like trial and error, feedback mechanisms, whatever it might be. But they're able to compress this very well. And I think that's a very interesting line of thought, because also with the kind of machines that we work with, you know, that's really what we see a lot of times. We see that these machines are able to, or these algorithms, I think it's better to call them algorithms because machines are a bit ambiguous, but these algorithms are able to compress information. They take lots of data that we give it as training data, and then we see, we say, okay, you know, compress this in a meaningful way to try to give us a specific output, you know. So depending on the task, the output could be anything. So say we're doing something very simple, you know, we'll take one of the simplest examples of, you know, modern AI, you know, just predicting if an image is a hot dog or not a hot dog, you know, very simple problem, but, you know, it takes a lot of preconditions to achieve this sort of output at the end, right? You need a bunch of images, and then you need to, you know, be able to tell, is this a hot dog? Is this not a hot dog? You know, also might be interesting for humans, right? Because, you know, we need to see a bunch of hot dogs and understand that, is this a hot dog? Is this not a hot dog? And then you get a general idea of what a hot dog is. You kind of compress it. And then the next time you see a hot dog, you're able to say, okay, this is a hot dog. So machines, in that sense, I think work in a similar way. So this intelligence as compression is something that's very relatable as a practitioner working in AI, and also as a concept for intelligence, I guess. Chinmay, maybe you have some thoughts to add on this?
Yeah, you said a lot of things that I would have, so I'll probably add some bit to that. So compression is a very interesting concept, right? So you go into the real world, you have all these perceptions. Yeah, get this all the sensory data on your eyes, in your ears. That's how your brain makes sense of the world, by stitching all of that together. But at the end of the day, you are just one person. You're just one person with a brain has really small size, and you live for 80 years, get so much information, and all of that information is condensed, compressed, and restructured in your own mind. And as you grow old, you start to digest it well, better and better over time. You start to integrate, you try to find patterns, you see patterns which you never saw before. So you basically abstract a lot of things from all this data in the real world. You find patterns which are generally applicable to other situations. So you can generalize. So this aspect of induction,
mm-hmm.
right? And this is really interesting, right? Because this abstraction is considered one of the hallmarks of intelligence. So any intelligent agent should, given any noisy data, for instance, in robotics, this is usually the case. Your robot, as it tries to navigate in an environment, there is some noise in the sensor, there's some noise in the environment, there's some ambiguity in the environment, there's some noise in its sensor. The robot doesn't really know anything about the world initially. But then as it goes around, it tries to build up its sensory information, tries to refine it over time, tries to build some internal representations of the world, which we can call as a map, which is basically a compressed version of its environment. So I completely agree with what Suraj just said about intelligence as compression perspective. So that's indeed one really important perspective. There are other perspectives also, like problem solving. So playing a game of chess is another, has long been considered a sign of intelligence. But then there are programs like AlphaGo, AlphaZero, I think.
AlphaZero,
one
yes.
of the newest ones, which can play, yeah. It can play chess, Go, Shogi really well on a superhuman level. And it has completely been trained from data. And that's a problem solving thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not intelligent beyond its, if you remove the board and put it in the real world, it will fail because it doesn't really, its domain of expertise
yeah,
is the board.
That's something
basically.
I was getting at. This is actually a new idea that I'm hearing, that intelligence is compression. I was looking at other definitions given by psychologists. So in a sense, what you're saying is that intelligence is the ability to take a lot of data and compress it efficiently so that it can tackle a given problem in a certain environment. But that's where I'm having a bit of hesitancy, because a lot of beings perform intelligent functions, right? For example, when bees are trying to find a new nest for their, a bunch of bees are trying to find a new nest, they do this pattern, infinity pattern or an egg pattern, and the angle they do it against the sun, this eight pattern, represents some kind of or direction in which the new nest is going to be, something like that. So in a sense, this is a function of intelligence, right? They are taking a lot of data and they're trying to focus it to a to solving a particular problem, but we don't call them intelligent. We call them functional in a sense. They are trying to solve a problem for a particular function of their existence. Shouldn't we say that then intelligence is the ability to compress and to find, basically to me, at least from a common man perspective, intelligence seems like something that an entity that can solve problems within a wide range of environments, right? And this problem could be solved through compression, through any other method, through biological means. For example, ants solve the problem of finding food through pheromones, right? That's a biological process. They don't do it intentionally to, in an intelligent manner, to solve the problem, but still they're getting the food they need. So in a way, to me, that feels like something that defines intelligence, which is to have this problem solving capacity over a wider range of environments. Would you agree with that? And how does compression fall into this perspective?
Yeah, I think that's a very, nice way to put it. For sure, you know, what bees do, you mentioned with the eight kind of cyclic pattern that they would have, that is definitely some form of intelligence. But I think, as you said, that's...
Would you call it intelligence?
Some form of intelligence, sure, right? Wouldn't you? Because, of course, it's driven by, you know, at the end, a very specific, like, reward mechanism, I guess, which they expect over time. But I would still think it is some form of intelligence. It might not be general intelligence, but it is probably still an intelligence mechanism at the end of the day. Again, with the whole compression thing, right? Sorry, I don't think we mentioned whose idea this is, which I think is very disrespectful. So the intelligence is compression was, I think, is proposed by Marcus Hutter, right, Chinmay? And he has a, I think you're a much better, you know, kind of fan of Marcus Hutter than I am. So maybe you should describe him for us, Chinmay.
Yeah, so indeed. So it's a very interesting idea. But wait, before I get to that, so I would like to say a word on the bees example, the example of insects being intelligent. I would call that it's like some form of collective intelligence, because one bee cannot be that perspective, I guess, because of the limitations of its body. But as a hive, as a swarm, they can communicate, and that communication, through that communication, there might be some form of an emergence phenomenon which creates a collective intelligence of some sort. So that's actually a thing that people are studying now in neuroscience, especially because it's also a phenomenon that you can see in human brain, right? What a human body essentially is just a mass of cells. So we are not even one coherent thing. It's just a bunch of cells gathered together doing their own thing. There is no centralized process that says every cell to do exactly something. It's not like top-down control system. So there, even the brain is like a bunch of neurons, and the action of these neurons, which is basically communicating with each other through electrical signals, that somehow creates this conscious experience. So that's really hard problem to bridge, going from neuroscience to mind. So in this sense, our intelligence is also at some point a collective intelligence of cells, I would say. That being said, intelligence as a compression is a very different form of looking at intelligence, right? So because what I said now is this emergent phenomena is this is a kind of a physics framework. You have these physical organisms where they come together, they communicate, and somehow something which is more than the sum of its parts emerges out of them, which is emergent, something, an emergent phenomenon, right? So, but the compression idea takes a very different approach. It takes the mathematical logic approach. So it's like a very algorithmic approach. It's a very theoretical idea. It assumes that you have, so this is a big shift in perspective, just to be clear. So you have, it's officially called AIXI. I'm not sure what exactly it stands for. It's just the name that's given to this mathematical framework by Marcus Hutter, the scientist who is working at DeepMind right now. And he's a theoretical computer science person. So these theories reflect that, basically. Mm-hmm. So this idea is that there's an agent which exists in an environment, and given infinite resources, it tries to find the optimal solution to reach its goal. So it's like a form of reinforcement learning system, but there are additional features to that. but you can simply think of it as a really supercharged reinforcement learning system. So it interacts with its environment, gets some feedback, tries to find the optimal solution so that it reaches its goal over time, given infinite resources. So this is a very theoretical idea. In the real world, we do not have infinite resources. Mm-hmm. No agent has infinite resources.
But But in that case, even with the infinite resources that a system has, it still has to pick out the best resource to perform the desired goal, the most optimal resource to perform that goal, right? Let's say the ultimate aim of chess is to checkmate a king, but you can do it with a queen, you can also do it with a bishop, you can do it with a knight. So I guess my question is that why do we need the infinite resources to call something intelligent? Because even with infinite resources, it still has to select the most optimal resources. And in that case, it should even be able to select the most optimal resource given there's only 5 resources, right?
So right. I don't think there's a need for infinite resources, right? Because we've seen these with systems that have already emerged, you know, with like Deep Blue for chess and with AlphaGo for Go. You know, these, of course, they had very vast resources in training, sure, but nowhere close to what infinite would actually be, right? And you know, they still found out what the optimal set of strategies or whatever it is for performing well in the game at certain points of time. And I think this, you know, what you mentioned a bit earlier as well, Chinmay, and what you mentioned now, I think I still think of compression as a very nice ideology, because why I brought that up as the first thing of intelligence is compression is because I think it relates mostly with what the field of AI sees as well. Because the way we build these systems in AI and in like modern AI, rather, I would rephrase, is that we look at these systems as a way of compressing things. We look at them as, you know, maybe this might be a bit technical, but I still get into it. Like, we look at them as function approximators. You know, by a function approximator, I mean something that maybe like a mapping. You know, we go from like an input to an output, and it's just a simple mapping. And, you know, these mappings can be extremely complicated. They can be pieced together through various different like modes, you know. So, for example, let's say for a game of chess, you know, you would have to observe where you are given in reference to the board, what pieces you have in reference to the board, what pieces exist for the opponent, you know, and how many pieces do you have remaining? How many pieces does your opponent have remaining? All of these things, you know, there's multiple different things of the state space that you need to capture and efficiently compress all of this and then map it to one singular action that is the most optimal action. So what I think is very interesting here is the compression exists in the ability to take various facets of information from different domains. You know, maybe a better example is also, you know, maybe a more general example of some of these agents that OpenAI and OpenAI have built that can operate in like, you know, general working environments. So they learn how to pick up objects, they learn how to manipulate objects, they learn how to, you know, place these objects in certain orientations, they learn how to then do various processes with these objects. And these involve so many systems, right? These involve like, it's a machine. So it first needs to see what's happening in the environment. Then it needs to get a physical model of the environment. Like, what does the object look like? What its dimensions might be. And then it needs to operate a hand through a motor system and then needs to grab it with the efficient, you know, amount of pressure that's needed to grab this and then pick it up and then learn how to release this and then learn how to put it. And there's also some abstract thinking because it also needs to plan this particular task. So it's looking at so many different modes of information, visual, then physics through the visual in some form, and then let's say abstract and all of these things together. And at the end of the day, it's performing like, let's say, one change in state space. So it's like predicting like the next action or the next most optimal action. So that's why I think this is such an interesting concept, because I think it also allows us to understand the current progress in AI. I'm not sure if it'll be good enough for like what comes after this, right? Because we see that there's a lot of, what I was referring to, what Chinmay mentioned is emergent properties, right? We haven't had systems that show very interesting emerging properties in AI until very recently. So with large language models, I think the amount of emergent properties they show has been magnificent. And, you know, that's why no other AI system has had this kind of public exposure and like where, you know, just people going crazy about this, tweeting about this. I'm sure some of them have had it just as, you know, a hype-based thing, but this actually works, right? And it works over a varied set of use cases. And yeah, maybe we save the detailed discussion for this later. But what I was trying to say is there's a lot of emergent properties in this. What we mean by emergent is these models have not been trained to do these sort of things. And these are properties that, emerge through a sum of the parts of the things that these models are built with. Very similar to what Chinmay said about like the human brain, right? Like we have, our brain is organized in certain ways and we get certain emergent properties. If we take out one single unit, we have no way of detailing how this leads to said emerging property at the end of the day. The same way we see it with AI. And I think the compression analogy is very good for some of the systems that are currently existing. But the second you go into more of these emergent properties, I think it gets more difficult because it goes beyond just compressing what has been given to it, right? It just goes into properties that we cannot really quantify based on what the inputs are.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, emergence is a very complex idea in itself, I guess, because basically what we're saying is that, like Chinmay mentioned before, that there is something irreducible, or it doesn't take a reductionist perspective in that the whole is not the sum of the parts, but there's also something more that we can't quite put our finger on. I mean, I was thinking that, so in this case, would you call intelligence as an emergent quality of consciousness?
I would say intelligence would be the ability to adapt to any given environment. Mm-hmm. And this ability to adapt has been emerged,
right,
as a process through the process of evolution, right? So because evolution does not really have this intelligent design, it's just a messy process that just keeps on going, right, through time. It's like a interaction of these tiny organisms with the environment, which is putting pressure, and the organisms need to adapt, need to change either consciously or biologically through mutations.
Right. So that's my point. If they are, that's a profound distinction, isn't it? Consciously or biologically, because if you take in the case of evolution, it's not like the polar bears decided one day to start turning white. I mean, it's not like the bears, brown or black bears, decided to start turning white in Arctic or polar regions because the brown ones are getting killed early, right? It's just that it's a genetic mutation that happened. And it just so happened that because that mutation, I mean, there must have been many mutations like that, right? There must have been a blue bear and a green bear or something. But it's just that the white bear survived through the process of natural selection. So in this case, the white bear didn't display any intelligent behavior. It was just a biological mutation that just happened to adapt itself to the environment. So I guess it's a systematic intelligence, I guess, like the entire world is intelligent in a sense. But I think mm-hmm. that's an important distinction to make, because if the choice is consciously made, then that would display intelligent behavior, because then it is goal driven. It is thinking of the end in mind and thinking, okay, if I do this step, then like if I turn white, then I'm not going to get killed. But that's not what happens in evolution. It's
right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. I completely agree.
But anyways,
so in evolution, you have...
Go ahead.
No, just to close this, right? So you have this process, which is like random, like you said, right? So it's a process that happens over generations. So many individuals need to die, right, basically, over millions of years, so that this genetic mutation could emerge, mm-hmm. and so that they could... Right? So that's a sort of a very rootless filtering. Right. Like this unconscious filtering going on in the background. And this is not technically intelligent if you think of an individual being as the agent,
but as
which should display individual behavior.
But again, this is again going back to the bees. Like you said, one bee cannot participate in this intelligent action, but if it's a bunch of bees, then they get to perform something resembling intelligence, right?
Right.
Yeah, I think, I think we should take a step back. I think we've digressed quite a bit from intelligence. But going back to artificial general intelligence. What is artificial general intelligence? and how is it different from other kinds of artificial intelligence?
Yeah, so maybe I can start off by talking about some of the specific intelligence we have, right? Because you say general and then, you know, you immediately think the other side of the boat is specific. So we've been seeing specific intelligent systems for a very long time now. And that's something that has been popularized by media probably a lot in the past decade, saying, you know, oh, AI can, you know, replace doctors in some sense, as you know, it can perform certain radiology functions by itself, and it can do self-driving cars, and it can replace like humans driving cars, and all of these things have become popular of late. But we've been seeing specific intelligence systems for a very long time now, and specific intelligence systems could be something as simple as, you know, you give it a very small task and you find a way of doing it in you know, a very, like, let's say a data-driven way or a very logical way that's not immediately obvious in its design, let's say. So that I think is, in my opinion, what an intelligence system would be. You don't design it in a sense to get to the output task in a very straightforward manner, or you don't understand the mapping between the input to the output. You don't predefine it.
But this is with specific AI you're talking about.
Yes, with specific intelligence. Okay. Yes, with like specific intelligence systems, you don't actually design how you get from the input to the output in a very predefined manner. But, you know, you have a lot of input data, you have a lot of output data, and then you kind of let the system figure out intelligent ways, or let the algorithm figure out intelligent ways to get from this input to the output. And we've seen a lot of these specific intelligence systems. You know, we've seen it for a lot of vision. We've seen this for example, like systems like optical character recognition, the ones that convert from, like, you know, handwritten text to computerized text. All of these things that have been existing for so long, and these are systems that have been designed with specific intelligence.
So, and I guess things like Alpha Go and Alpha Zero, Alpha Fold, all these fall under specific intelligence, right?
Yes, I would say so. Yeah, they have, you know, the systems that are used to build it, they're built very specific to that particular domain. Yes, but you know, the models, or like, let's say the methodology in which they're kind of designed, they could be translatable to more general systems as well. For example, you know, they're built using like what I mentioned earlier, like certain function approximators, right?
Yeah, so can you elaborate on what's a function?
Yes, so. What I think is a function approximator in this sense is, you know, you have very simple mathematical functions that we understand, right? For example, let's say a function approximator is adding one. So you give it any number and it adds one. That's a very simple function. So you give it three and the result is four. That's a very simple function that we understand. Now you could make this much more complex, and we need to make it much more complex because the problems we have are much more difficult than adding one to a particular number. So now we have a very complicated problem of, you know, let's say what AlphaGo does, right? You have a very complicated problem there. And then you need a much more complex function approximator that we cannot determine, because we need to go from a particular state space in the game and we need to say what the next action might be. And that's a very complicated mapping. And that requires a function approximator that's way more complex than just adding one. And we don't know. We might know, like, you know, experts in Go might know certain strategies, okay, might know certain rules that you might come up with to, you know, have the best representation in that space, state space, and then say what the next move is. They understand this through their years of experience. But, you know, it's very hard to actually boil this down into rules, right? Because the search space is so huge. How many rules would you write? You know, you have so many possible places the pieces could be, and you have so many possible actions that you can take and the results of those actions. So how would you write this down? It's almost impossible to actually, I think, especially for Go. I mean, even for chess, it would be quite impossible to actually write down rules for this search space, but for Go, even more so. Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that what differentiates artificial general intelligence from specific intelligence are these function approximators? Like, is that what you're saying?
So what I meant to say is these function approximators are common across both general and specific intelligence in my opinion, and also, you know, with the methods that we have built for now. But the way these function approximators are trained, or let's say the way these function approximators are learned, are very specific to a particular use case in these specific intelligent systems. So for example, for these specific intelligent systems, you know, you have these function approximators learned specifically to play chess or to play Go. So they understand what the inputs are in reference to the game. They understand the state space in reference to the game. And then they say, okay, you know, we learn these function approximators. These function approximators can be something general, but the way you learn them would be more specific. And then, you know, you learn them in a specific way to perform really well in that particular, you know, game or in that particular setting. Now, with the systems that we're trying to build for general intelligence, I think we still have the same function approximators, but we have better ways of learning them to offer more general intelligence. We weren't really successful in having these function approximators learn very general forms of, or to represent general forms of intelligence until very recently. Of course, there's been some systems that are, you know, marked as milestones in, you know, AI, but none of them, I think, were as good or close to being called like general intelligence until, you know, these new era of GPT systems have come about. And they're still using these function approximators. That's the amazing thing, right? We're still using the same way of building function approximators, but we found very amazing ways to learn them. And this is what is leading to, you know, them doing really well with general intelligence as well. So we actually have very similar ways to tackle both general and specific intelligence in terms of like the models we build. You know, they're all function approximators essentially, but how we learn them can be very different. And I think that also adds a lot of challenging aspects, right? Like learning a function approximator for something simplistic or something specific is, as you would imagine, much easier than learning it for something more general purpose. Like it's much easier to teach, like even as humans, right? It's much easier to teach someone a very specific thing as I'm going to say, you know, I'm going to teach my kid how to play chess. You know, that's easier than teaching my kid how to live in the real world, or like how to, you know, have abstract reasoning in the real world, how to have, you know, planning to execute certain things in the real world. It gets much more tricky. So that's why we weren't able to figure this out.
Mm-hmm. A common definition for, not definition, but an evaluating factor, I guess, for an artificial intelligence system to be called intelligent is the Turing test, right? Whether a human can tell whether or not they're interacting with a machine. But any of these specific AI sets would fail a Turing test, wouldn't they?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. No, that's right, completely. So, like you said, if you have a program that plays chess or folds proteins, it doesn't have the engineered mechanisms to produce text. It cannot speak, it cannot communicate. So it cannot do anything else other than what it's designed to do. So in that case, it's right. Extremely narrow.
But do you think a Turing test is an appropriate measure to measure intelligence?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of like debates about this very recently, again, spiked by this whole GPT stuff. That's why I think it's a very good time for us to do this podcast, Ravi, because I think it's a very good time for AI as well. There's been so many things that's recently come to emergence, or rather like re-emergence. These topics have been discussed before. These topics have been deliberated on before, but now they found more respect in the public sphere, right? People are taking this more seriously, because they know that this problem, you know, this whatever the effect of this is more immediate, rather. So I think the Turing test is, again, I will fall back to using GPT as a example, because that's the best example of general or like artificial general intelligence that we have now. I don't think it's an AGI by any means, but it's the closest thing we have to an AGI for now. And I would be willing to gamble that I don't know if it actually passed the Turing test. There's a lot of articles that say it did, but then there's also a lot of articles that say that these were like erroneous claims. I wasn't able to get down to actually find out if it did pass, but I think it would to a very decent extent pass the Turing test, unless it's asked very specific functional competence questions where we know it fails. So if the evaluator is not privy to the failures of GPT and doesn't know where ChatGPT would fail, then I think it would pass the Turing test for sure, because you wouldn't really drill down into these functional competences unless you know that they exist. So yeah, I think it would pass the Turing test. And, that makes us think, and I can't say this for 100% sure, but I would be willing to bet a lot of my money that GPT models are not sentient. And I think that was one of the, that's where, we say that, okay, the Turing test might, wait, so did you mean sentient or intelligent?
The Turing test
for sentience or for intelligence?
Not sentient, yeah.
Okay, for intelligence. So even for intelligence, I think it's, then I think the question gets
what
a lot more
tricky. Basically mean is, would you say the Turing test is an outdated form of evaluation?
Yes, I would say, yeah, I would say, because I don't think it was built, in context of modern artificial intelligence systems, because I think when this whole Turing test was designed, we were looking as AI researchers, we were looking to build more general systems that mimic human intelligence. And we didn't really think that we would get into this whole barrage of very well-performing specific intelligence systems. And I think these are, like you said, right, with the Turing test, these systems wouldn't be called intelligent, really. But then would we subjected to the same Turing test? Would we have maybe an alternate version of the, or a limited domain Turing test? You play chess, but then you show it chess played by an AI and a chess played by human, and then ask someone to say, who's playing this, right? Is it an AI or is it played by a human? Same thing for other tasks, right? Like a self-driving car, You just show a video of a car driving across highways, and then you say, was this being driven by a human or was this being driven by an AI? So a limited domain Turing test, right? And then, systems we have now, they would pass it too, because there's no way to actually tell apart a self-driving car unless you subject it to very specific conditions where we know it fails. And I think that's the problem with the Turing test now. We need more elaboration, and we need more testing once we identify cases where they fail, rather than very general cases of just telling, is this something that's being done by a human or is it being done by an AI? Because, Chinmay said, in a lot of systems, we've surpassed human performance. It's superhuman in performance. So maybe we don't need to compare it to a human anymore. Maybe we need to compare it to other failure cases that a human possibly doesn't make, a human may not make those. A human may make those failure cases, but the system may not make those. But then a system may make very different failure cases that we just don't know yet.
Okay, so the core idea, I think that's still valid, right? So the core idea behind Turing test, when Turing devised this test, 1940s or 50s, whatever, was that if you have a system which is intelligent, then it should be able to convince a human being, an evaluator, that it is, in fact, intelligent. It's a tricky, right? So it's possible that the system is faking intelligence. It's not intelligent, but it's faking. Or maybe it's faking consciousness or something like that. So it's not really conscious, but it's faking that it's conscious. And people argue that, does faking mean that it might as well be conscious?
Yeah,
so it's it's a tricky question.
That's the first question that popped in my head.
Right?
If it's faking intelligence, isn't it intelligent enough to fake intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, it has all recipes to fake an intelligence, right? So it must be intelligent Chinmay, go ahead.
Right, so I think this more kind of applies to consciousness, because intelligent to fake intelligent, you have to be intelligent, right? You have to be intelligent. So you cannot be dumb, and your system cannot be dumb and show that it's intelligent. So that's so.
Right.
But
I
consciousness
guess,
is a whole different
more,
problem.
Because, accurately to consciousness. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, so that being said, the reason that, so there's been some discussions about why Turing even chose language as a test for intelligence, right? So that's a very interesting thing by itself, because language
fair
is...
Fair point, yeah.
Right? So because language is the primary mode of communication. And once you can have a system that speaks like a human, during that time, I think he might have also been influenced by other people around him. He was a logician, right? So mathematical logic was his bread and butter. And then he was also influenced apparently by people like Wittgenstein, people from giants in linguistic philosophy, and that might have been a reason for him to suggest that language is a good test for intelligence. It's really close to human mind because it's easy to imagine that your thought processes are happening in a linguistic representation, right? So you think in terms of words, and if you can produce words, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, this is digressed into something else. Interestingly, I didn't know that Turing was inspired by Wittgenstein, first of all, but Wittgenstein's ideas themselves are quite interesting from a linguistic sense, because for him, there is nothing hidden from language. Logic and language for Wittgenstein was kind of the same. That's why predicates exist in existing grammar as well as logic, right? So for Wittgenstein, there was nothing that you could hide from language. Whatever you can be expressed through language. Whereas someone like Thomas Nagel, so Nagel wrote this paper called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? So we're digressing into consciousness now. According to Nagel, there is something it is like to have the experience of a bat. And that's something we can call it qualia. Qualia are these subjective experiences that each individual has. And for Nagel, it is that subjective experience of a bat is inaccessible to anyone else. I cannot know what it's like to be a bat because I can never transcend my own consciousness and put myself in the bat's shoes, metaphorically speaking. So there's something that's absolutely inaccessible, yeah, in the subjective experience of consciousness. That's what Nagel felt. Whereas Wittgenstein took the diametrically opposite sense, right? He thought there is nothing that is inaccessible. He felt that if you can express it through language or logic, I might be wrong in saying this, but as I see Wittgenstein, for him, logic and language kind of are synonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Turing, again, this is just, I'm just connecting ideas, that maybe Turing felt that if he was a Wittgensteinian, it makes a lot more sense to have language as a method to test the sentience or consciousness of an object, because there's nothing that's inaccessible, everything is there. So if we know that a system is acting conscious, then I guess it's conscious, right? I'm not sure if I'm making a lot of sense. This is a new idea in my head, but
yeah, but no, I think that's some amazing connections, actually. Like, it's very interesting to think that, you know, that's how the Turing test was kind of centered around language and just like communication through language. And we find out now that this is exactly kind of, you know, we see that there is a clear disassociation between like language and consciousness, right? Because of, you know, certain ways we're seeing with these systems. So it's amazing how these things come about. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. So now that we have moved to consciousness, so Chinmay, maybe you can expand upon how you're interested, from what perspective you're interested in consciousness, and like, do you consider any of these large language models conscious because of the intelligence and other qualities they express, or what do you think of consciousness in terms of AI?
For me, it's hard to put my finger on whether exactly they are conscious or not. So there's this problem in philosophy, it's the hard problem of consciousness, right? So you have, how does a mind, like the qualia, emerge from the hardware, which is the neurons or like silicon on your computer? So that's, no one has been able to crack that. And yeah, so it's interesting if you look at a large language model like GPT-3, 4, whatever, the newest one, and open it up. So it's a neural network. It's essentially a big neural network with lots of parameters. So these are the analogous to the connections in connections between the neurons in your brain. So this is kind of like a model for that. So these are called the parameters. And these parameters represent the learned structure. So that's what they learn from the data. And if you try to like open the model, look at the parameters, look at these neural network weights, and try to find some patterns in them, then you give input and then see how that reacts, how these neurons fire, which part of the network fires. Just like you would do as a neuroscientist, you would do experiments on the brain. You give some stimulus and see which part of the brain lights up, something like that. I'm not sure if you can get to the decision that whether the system is conscious or not only from that experiment, because then if you do, then you solve the hard problem of consciousness, right? So then that's which hasn't been done. So that may not be the best way to do it. But if I can speculate, then I don't think they are conscious, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, like this works within a framework, right? Like, you know, Wittgensteinian framework where language is all that exists, everything expressible can be expressed through language and logic, then these machines should be conscious, because whatever neural patterns that emerge in our head, you can model them similarly in something like GPT-4, and it's expressing similar patterns, similar functions, similar reasoning, intelligence, and all these things. So I guess, like, from a Wittgensteinian model or from a Turing perspective, it should be conscious, but there is no unified and academically accepted framework for how consciousness works. You touched upon the hard problem of consciousness. It's called hard because this has to do with our inability to transcend our own conscious experience and experience it through another subject.
No, but I get it. So if you assume the Wittgensteinian view that language, logic as a like sort of operating system for mind, then you would argue that ChatGPT or GPT-4 is conscious because it can it can produce text really well, and that connects. I think that connects to what Suraj mentioned a word before, which is the functional competence of a language model, right? So. So what these guys, so there was this cognitive science paper, which we had a look at before this podcast. They split linguistic competence. So you have a model which is really good at language, like GPT-4. Now, what does it mean? So you split this linguistic competence into two parts. So one is formal competence and one is functional competence. Formal competence relates to the language construction, the grammar, the abstraction. So if you switch a noun with another noun, the sentence still has its structure and the network still recognizes it or produces it. So the grammatical thing. And it turns out that the network, these models are really good at that. Really good at...
At formal competence, you mean?
Yes, indeed, yeah. So they're really good at formal sense of this linguistic competence. But when you talk about functional, so functional is a tricky part, right? Because... functional relates to how you interact in the real world using language. So how you reason,
exactly,
given a circumstance, how you communicate very efficiently your ideas to someone so that they get it. So how you perform, how you combine your visual information, like what you see and the way you act in the world, you get feedback, and how can you integrate all of that into a language and convey that. So that's something that's really missing in these models. They are not embodied. They don't have any other means to interact with the world. So they only have language.
Right.
In that case, since that big component is missing, but in human beings, we have that big component, and that's what makes us competent agents in the real world. I think that deficiency makes these models incapable of consciousness at this point.
Mm. Interesting. And also, I mean, like, embodiment, I guess, is the big challenge also, right? Like, on a very commonsensical note, we think of any conscious being as embodied. Large language models, they're just a model. They can't build up, at least for now, I guess, they can't build up on previous interactions. They don't have the memory aspect. Memory is something that we consider very important for a sentient being, a conscious being, right?
Right.
They lack that ability. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So, no, yeah, indeed. So I was just repeating what you said. So they lack the memory capability. So that's, there are people who are trying to combine GPT-4 with the separate memory module, like to augment them with this. So that's like some interesting line of work in cognitive science now.
Yeah, I think, for sure, Ravi. I think that's a very, well-explored flaw of it right now. So one of the things that, so I was just reading up a lot of experiments with GPT, and one of the things that you see occur across a few of these is there is a lack of introspection in these models. Something I think that we with consciousness really have. And you can see this, like, there's a very simple test they did to kind of observe this. So they asked it, you know, how many prime numbers between, you know, two numbers. And then it gave it a wrong answer. And then, you know, they kind of reprompted it and asked that, you know, can you list all the prime numbers between this number and that number? And then at that time, it listed it correctly. And it was different from the original wrong estimate, of course. And then it corrected its previous estimate and said, okay, you know, yeah, I was wrong. This is my, you know, updated answer. So it's able to correct itself when you ask it. But, you know, it's not able to introspect itself, right? Because it wouldn't have gotten this wrong if it already had, like, I don't know, say some kind of like inner dialogue and like it's able to already break this down into like appropriate steps, because that's how we as humans would do it, right? Like if you're asked to list prime numbers between two numbers, you'd probably actually just list all of them down or like have a nice way of like, you know, estimating between those ranges and then give a count, right? You wouldn't immediately, like, that's the thing. I think a lot of things with language models go kind of backwards, you know? It's very much based on distribution statistics and probability, the outputs of these models, that, you know, it's not more logic driven, it's more probability driven, which results in this kind of behavior. You know, they give you the wrong answer, and then when you ask it for the correct answer, it can kind of, you know, go back into that probability distribution and come up with like better answers, sure, but it's not able to do this, you know, originally, because it doesn't have like an inner dialogue. Very similar to how we as humans.
Yeah, that's interesting. But yeah, I want to kind of move on. We've been talking about the more formal aspect of AI and more about the conscious elements or the intelligence. But I want to move to the practical side of what it means to live in a world that is going to be flooded with intelligent machines. So, and broadly speaking, I want to speak about the future of what AI can do for us. And to do that, I would like to ask you, looking back over the past 10 years, I guess OpenAI is the one really big player that's been working on AI since like 2010, right? So let's say over the past 10 years, or even if you want to go back, what do you think are some significant milestones in the field?
Yeah, so I think... yeah, there's been quite a few milestones in the past decade, maybe two decades actually, to you know, be more conservative about it. And this has been since you know, what started with like big data, or like since we've been able to tackle vast amounts of data, collect them, store them, use them in a meaningful way to train these like deep models. Because we did have an idea of deep models or like neural networks that are significantly like, you know, deep, and by deep they have many hidden states is how we would say it. And these hidden states allow it to represent very complex mappings. So I mentioned that it's a function approximator earlier, and by the deep network, it means kind of that you can estimate very complex functions. So we had an idea of how to do this technically. We just didn't have the data or like the best way to learn this until you know, some of these more modern models came out. So I think with language, there's been, I'm not an expert in language, but there's been a lot of systems that have come about in language. There's been like a huge you know, uptick since one of the first transformer models came out. I think that's one of the biggest you know, milestones in language models. I think that was in 2017, so that's not too far away at all, actually. So language really picked up in a very short period of time. I think for vision, for computer vision, where, you know, you take images and, you know, have various sort of deep learning models attached to natural images or like medical images, I think this happened much earlier. So there were a lot of these, like, I think Linette was one of the first models. I don't exactly remember when it came out. Maybe Chinmay, you do remember. Was it 2012, 2016?
I think Linette was really...
2015?
I think it was in 90s. Linette was in 90s.
No, no, the Linette by Yann LeCun, right? Was it in the 90s?
Yeah, I thought it was also in the 2000s, but this was an old paper.
Oh, wow, okay.
But the milestone that really kicked off computer vision AI was in 2012 with AlexNet.
AlexNet, right? Yeah.
So AlexNet was like this neural network, so it had these like brain like neuron like computations stacked up on, that's what the deep part, because you have hierarchical, it extracts hierarchical features, like features, then features of features, first order, second order features from the image. So it learns to get this very complex information from the images and then map that to whatever it's asked. So is that image a cat? So it extracts at pixel level, and then it combines the pixel with higher order semantic information, and then it goes to the end and then says it if it's a cat or if it's not. For example, if it's a cat classifier, AlexNet is one such kind of neural network, and that was proposed in 2012, I believe. And what really kicked off this was the data, of course, because in machine learning you really need a lot of data to train and to validate properly. And so there was this ImageNet dataset released by Stanford? I think it was Stanford.
Yeah, I think it was Stanford too.
Yeah, so these guys released a collection of big database of images. The idea was to train AI models on that. And that really opened the door for training these big neural networks, which are data-hungry models. And then other research groups around the world, other companies followed suit. They also released big data sets for audio, for text. So people could train language models, people could train audio. And indeed, in 2017, we had this big breakthrough with the Transformer architecture. So Transformer is a kind of a neural network which has attention modules, so it can actually focus. Like, the way human attention works is that we find some salient features in the scene where we focus on and ignore everything else, something like that, right? So this Transformer architecture has this sort of attention mechanism inside it. So it really, if you feed it a sentence, it can focus to predict the next word. It can check which words in the previous part of the sentence are salient. And that was like key in the success of these models. That led to things like GPT, because GPT, under the hood, it uses a transformer neural network. So that was a key enabler indeed, yeah. And yes, so other things like AlphaFold, like you mentioned, Ravi, before. So that's also a big scientific breakthrough. It solved a problem which people have been struggling for years. So going from genes, so if your cells have a bunch of genes, and going from just looking at the gene, how the protein will take shape. So that's the protein folding problem. Mm-hmm. Just looking at the genome and predicting the shape of the protein. I think that's the right formulation. So that was a hard problem. People really wanted to solve it there so that they can apply it to drug discovery or things like that, practical applications like that.
I guess because proteins have, like, to make drugs, you need to first map the 3D structure of these proteins so that you can see where to, in the 3D structure, place another element or another molecule. But mm-hmm. I guess that's, to me, that's like, that sounds, I'm not very familiar with it, but it sounds like a significant achievement. Also because from what I was reading, it would take a PhD student an entire doctoral dissertation just to map the 3D structure of one protein, and AlphaFold can do it in what, like 30 seconds, 20 seconds. That can significantly boost our research in medicinal fields. So I think, yeah, definitely, mm-hmm. that sounds like something that's really useful. It also makes me wonder why we are so keen on producing these general intelligence models rather than like going for like goal-specific things. For example, we have a problem of, let's say, water shortage. Should like we use some kind of AI mechanism to get a efficient, economical way to desalinate water from the ocean? We have so much ocean water, right? But yeah, that's just a random thought in my head. Why we are so, as humans, we are so keen on, we are so fascinated also. Like, a lot of people who didn't know about the developments in AI, now when they look at ChatGPT, me included, I'm a lot more fascinated by that than rather than like solving a particular problem, which truly is more useful, more practicable, and more interesting, I guess. I mean, of course, ChatGPT as a general intelligence model is something that's novel also. I guess that's novelty is a big part of why we're so fascinated by it. But yeah, anything else you think in the past few years that changed, moved the curve upwards significantly?
I think probably funding in AI as well. Like, that's also been a huge aspect of AI, right? Because these AI winters that we had in between were like, what I mentioned was a lot of these technical things were already discovered before, But then there were a lot of these winters which were characterized by like drops in AI funding. You know, they didn't have government funds. They didn't have a lot of like, you know, private funding as well. But since these systems that, you know, Chinmay mentioned correctly, the AlexNet was one of the first ones in Vision. And then, you know, several of them like came about after that. And, you know, Vision became a very interesting space and a lot of problems were now being solved with superhuman accuracy. And, you know, that's one of the first things that, you know, now the government and also companies jump into, right? So a lot more funding becomes accessible to research, both in academia and in industry. And I think that's a huge part of what led these developments. So if you see in like the recent past, right, a lot of big AI developments, AI research developments, let me also rephrase, have come from companies, which is super interesting because in many other fields, research doesn't really come out of industry. Research comes out mostly from academia. Like the vast majority of research comes out from academia and then maybe moves on to industry if it finds, you know, if it's time tested and if it's proving useful in some specific use cases. But with AI, what's fascinating is a lot of like any of the big milestones, right? You take Transformers, you take, you know, GPT, you take like any of these vision models that have come up after, you know, AlexNet. And all of these have come, like most of the big ones have come from industries, which is fascinating, which means that companies see a lot of potential in investing their funding resources into building these. And by their funding resources, it's, you know, it's either like stockholder money or it's like, you know, funding money, which means they see a realistic impact of these things in the immediate future. Because the thing with academic research is you will get funding despite of it having immediate impact in the future, right? It's, you know, you see that, is this a valuable research direction for humanity to explore? You know, and then you say, okay, we dedicate funding to this because we want to know, you know, it pushes the boundary of us being human, or like, as, you know, the name of your podcast is, you know, it improves the human condition in some sense, you know. But with industry, you would only spend money on it if you think there is an immediate, by immediate, I don't know, I mean, like 5 years, 10 years, whatever, right?
I mean, they're capitalistic entities.
Exactly.
Right? So
yes.
They want to,
yes,
increase profit. Yeah.
Exactly. So, which is very interesting for a field, I think, that research is being dictated by industry rather than academia, which I think is amazing and also scary and threatening at the same time. Because while I think having an influx of funding just pushes research by, you know, milestones, which is what has happened, I think if industry was not a part of this, we wouldn't have seen all of these systems by now. Would have probably taken a couple more decades, to be very honest. Academia is extremely slow and a lot of red tape. I'm sure Chinmay agrees as a person working in academia.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's also extremely threatening because these systems are not validated as well. They're not validated as extensively because they're built for the pure purpose of being used rather than of, you know, being like, you know, researched for their, rather than explored, exactly. Being researched for their viability, being researched for how they can actually be used and should they be used, why they be used, and all of these, you know, finer aspects. So I think that's something that I don't see with any other field, and that's something that's it scares me, to be honest, as a person working in academia.
Mm. Right. So AI is more like an engineering discipline now than a scientific one. So you build tools for production to use them in the real world. And not to analyze it and discover something. I mean, there are universities do that, right? So people use large language models as models of human language center of the brain to study how a brain might respond to certain linguistic stimuli, for instance. But again, that's just like marginal compared to what industry is doing with these. Like ChatGPT is like a commercial product at this point, right? So it's And just to train the GPT-3, which is like the back end of this model, or GPT-3.5, GPT-4 even, the newest one, I believe they need to burn like $1 million just to train one model. And I don't think any university can afford that, right? Because funding is a problem in the university. People have to apply for grants to do research. But commercial entities like companies like OpenAI, DeepMind even, they have this sort of a monopoly over large models, so only they can train and deploy these large models. So there's this sort of asymmetry currently, and that's kind of a debated thing right now.
Yeah. But moving on to a more even more practical question that a lot more people are legit scared about is perhaps ChatGPT right now can do, I don't know, more than half the jobs in the world better than what humans can do. So everyone's, of course, scared of losing their jobs. And what do you think about that aspect of AI? Do you really think, foresee people unemployed, or do you see AI as a tool to empower people to create more jobs and reduce the friction in economy?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen this kind of before on a different situation, right? We've seen the Industrial Revolution happen, and we've seen people with like very similar fears, you know, machines coming in, a lot of our jobs going away. But I frankly think we've had better quality of jobs since then. We've had overall, you know, on average, a better quality of life. And we've had, you know, definitely, if you look at more developed countries, right, where a lot more industrial automation exists and economies are more stable, you see people exploring a whole range of, you know, jobs and professions that you don't see people in developing countries with much worse industrial automation and with much worse economies have. So I think these sort of real life demonstrations kind of give me a positive outlook on this, in that, you know, making these systems accessible to everyone would probably also be very similar to a second coming of the Industrial Revolution, but this would be more of a LLM revolution. Not a catchy name, probably needs a rephrase, but yeah, that would be, you know, the next wave coming, improve quality of life for people, take away a lot of jobs that are, I don't think really any person who has a job entering data into an Excel sheet and, you know, processing certain outputs really wants to do it, no matter how conditioned they've been into thinking that this is a part of their life and this is a part of their person. I don't think, you know, they would want to do something like that. There are better creative you know, human professions that would give us the best of, lend to us being that we're human. You know, we have much better things that we can do rather than have these, you know, menial jobs that give us a sense of, you know, purpose in life, I would say. Yeah. But I think, again, the same thing I would think with Industrial Revolution, right? Like what I mentioned is with developed countries and developing countries, there's obviously a disparity in how these things have been distributed across the world. So there is also potential for this to be disparate, for you know, access to LLM models or access to AI to be disparate in the world. So would that then also create bias towards more resourceful countries or countries with, you know, better resources, and then leave countries that are worse off now be even further worse off? So, for example, I would think this was a very interesting thing that was shared on Twitter. You know, someone wanted to outsource a job to, you know, someone in a developing country. I think it was either India or Bangladesh. And then, you know, they used GPT, found a really nice way to just get their app done. And, you know, that's it. That took away a job from someone in India or Bangladesh, you know, outsourcing countries. So does it take away and make the developing world worse, kind of? And does it, like, you know, make the developed country better and just increase this disparity? I think that's a worthy debate, rather than, I'm 100% sure it'll improve the quality of life for people, take away jobs, but leave them better. But how disparate will this then be is really what I'm thinking.
I completely agree. So you have this automation of, if you go back to the Industrial Revolution, the automation of the mechanical labor, right? So you had, when the industries came up, people started being employed in factories. There was a lot of manual labor. People started mining stuff, like a lot of people working in really bad conditions. And then you started to digitalize these factories, basically, right? So you added these control systems, you added electronic automations. And then the need for the repetitive manual labor was somewhat erased. And that was indeed, in my opinion, that's indeed a positive change. And then, okay, so that the mechanical part, so this heavy machines automated the mechanical part. Now the question is, what about the intellectual part? So people started using computers. There are many jobs created using computers, like, content creation, especially large-scale content creation. And then now the question is, how much improvement would one see if these jobs are also automated? And how much, I mean, Yeah.
I mean, also the transferability of skill matters, right? People who were working in a field, in a farm during the Industrial Revolution didn't have too much trouble working in a factory, for example, because it's your operating machines, but you still have to do it. You just have one technique or one way to operate on a machine. Whereas I'm just thinking like, because we are doing this comparison with the Industrial Revolution, I think the scale at which jobs are going to disappear is a lot more. This is going to explode exponentially. Let's say even, for example, I guess all three of us can agree that driving is going to be automated very soon. Like we already have Tesla, but once you remove driving, which is a lot more safer, I would believe, and a lot more efficient, and so then think of, there's like millions of truck drivers around the world, right? And their only skill would be to drive a truck. So how do you train these people to transfer their skills to an AI supportive environment? I think that's the big question that governments and we as a society have to look at. Of course, a lot of these content creators in the past 3-4 years, they've exploded like crazy with the advent of Instagram and TikTok. And now you can make content making is so easy with AI, generative AI. You literally have all the tools, video, audio, and text. So, but they still have some transferable skills. But I guess we have to look more at the transferability of skills and start training people to use more AI. And again, like Suraj said, this will be a lot more easier in developed countries rather than developing countries. So that's again a challenge of what kind of disparity it's going to create. I mean, these are all profound questions. I don't think anyone has the answers right now of how the system as a whole is going to adapt to the rise in AI and losing jobs.
But I think, like you said, I think training is a very key part of this. I think that's probably, in my mind, the best nearsighted option, at least, or even longsighted, actually, because I think in a matter of years, you know, it's not even a decade, I think in a matter of years, people who are very proficient in using GPT and large language models will replace people who are not. This is already happening, you know, like consultants with GPT are so much more powerful in what they can provide than consultants without GPT. You know, researchers with GPT so much more better in writing papers that can communicate science to a larger audience than researchers without GPT. So, you know, this will kind of, you know, propagate, and people who don't know how to use it will be pushed out of the field, and funding will divert from hiring more human resources to then having more AI resources or AI technology in parts of the pipelines. So, you know, you have to kind of upskill yourself. Like you said, I think transferability of skill is a very, very crucial factor. And, you know, truck drivers, Uber drivers, you know, Lyft drivers, they're going to be, you know, it's going to be a very difficult time for them, because people like me, people like the three of us, right, we're in a very nice position to actually start using GPT and replace a lot of our workflows with that. I think Chinmay and me even more so, because we're in this field and we know how these things work, and we know exactly kind of what we might use them for, where it might, you know, not be a good use case for it. And yeah, so I think people in tech, again, get the better end of this one, and people who are not in tech face the worst end of the straw. So I think training is probably the only thing that can like make this more equal. And
yeah, I agree. I mean, for people who are, like you said, this, again, disparity is the word that comes to mind, because, again, people who are already adept at using something like ChatGPT or any generative AI model, it will reduce a lot of friction to start new things like jobs and reduce the economic friction. Because right now, like let's say 5 years ago, if you want to start a company, you have to think of a lot of aspects that can't be automated.
Right.
You need someone like a caretaker. Like right now, that friction is reduced, but then it is a lot more harder for someone like whose skill cannot be transferred to this. So I think that's a key point we as a society should think about, and how we can cope with the loss of these jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been looking out, like just following the artist community, right? So you have these artists who work professionally, right? So and they create these concept arts and they upload it on something on a platform like ArtStation. And share it with the world, or even Instagram and share it with the world. And then you have this sudden influx of, like LLMs, you have these in the image space, right? So you have these image synthesis models, like these diffusion models. What they do is you can prompt it, like you can say what kind of a scene you want, and this model will paint that scene for you within half a second. And you can choose what level of granularity you want. Should it look like painting? Should it look like a photorealistic image? Where should this object be located? What's the style of this image? Should it be surrealistic? Should it be like sketch? You can like prompt complex things and you can get those kind of images. And people are really like, I mean, some people are really like pissed because someone who's honed their skills for like years and years in art, and then someone comes along and says, oh, look at my AI art, who just prompted. And then the question is, who made this art? Was it you who created the genius prompt, or was it the model's genius for creating this piece from the prompt? And who should the credit go to? And then I see that these guys, like these artists protest, they say, okay, say no to AI art. So they had this logo, and they created this thing, a meme, and they started circulating it.
Like a Facebook profile photo, yeah, yeah. I imagine.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Like it became a meme. So it just like spread like crazy. Yeah.
But this is also a lawsuit, right? It's a lawsuit in the US against Stable Diffusion and Stability AI. People have gone out and gotten I forget what it's called, but it's a class action lawsuit, right? Multiple people come together and say, you know, we all want to sue it for this collective thing, split lawyer fees, whatever. But it's way more powerful because it's by an entire class or like a community of people rather than one person. So there's a class action lawsuit against the Stability, saying they've used copyrighted images from, you know, from a lot of content creators. And because, you know, what AI produces is a very dependent process on the data it's been fed. So you're violating copyright by using it. And just today, I also saw an article on GPT models. So I think the EU has also asked OpenAI to release exact contents of its training data to see if there's been any copyrighted text or copyrighted data, like maybe from like some journal, like, I don't know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, whatever. And then it will make a decision if you know, it wants to allow unrestricted access to GPT models through this release. So I think a lot of legal issues people are you know, starting to see where this might actually affect the community and what legal issues they might want to tackle. But I think, again, the scary thing with this is if you ban it and make it restricted use, again, it increases disparity. I think people who know how to access this will find a way to access this. Again, makes it more disparate for people who know how to use this tech rather than just the general populace, I guess. Because, yeah, I mean, given how globalized the world is, there's no real way you can actually ban something on the internet, right? It's you can find a way to access it if you just know how. Yeah, the law is catching up, it seems like. But again, they're also very misinformed. I don't know if you guys have seen the Senate deposition of the TikTok founder. So one of the senators was his question genuinely to him was, does TikTok use my home Wi-Fi internet? Does it access my home Wi-Fi internet when it starts? Does it have access to that information? That's what he asked him as a form of threat to his privacy, right? But then he was like, Senator, it is an internet application. That's how it works. You know, it has to access like the Wi-Fi. So, you know, the issue is, people, legislators are not aware, like, at least in the United States, and I assume the EU is much better in these aspects, absolutely, for sure. But in the United States and the rest of the modern world, you know, legislators themselves don't know how these systems work, right? So, you know, it's just going to be a game of catch up for them. And by then, you know, it would already have so much of impact. So it's high time we actually start training people, because that's the only thing that can...
Absolutely. I agree 100% to that. I think it's the only alternative to, rather than sit and complain, because the world is just going to keep moving.
Oh, yeah.
Without you. Yeah. So,
yeah. We like Modi, it or not, it's going to happen. You know, we don't have a choice. That's the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Modi, if you're listening, bro, need to start training people, bro.
get India on the front lines of this,
right?
This
is it. I mean, like, if you want to think futuristic, this is your choice. You'll get like a even start with other folks if you start training now. You know?
Yes, yes. Har ghar GPT, you know.
Yeah, dude.
Pay me for this quote. Like,
done. Har ghar GPT.
Yeah, but no, yeah, I think it's very crucial to have this. It's, yeah, I don't know how you would actually get training modules across fields. It's a very challenging question again, you know, but yeah. We don't want to be left playing catch up to like things
that happen. We got to figure out a way to do this, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point to end it, guys. It's been really informative for me. Like, I think we've touched on a lot of subjects that I can now go into a rabbit hole and like explore deeper. I think we've only superficially touched a lot of things. But thank you so much, guys. I think it's been a great podcast, and try it. I mean, like, to be honest, one of the reasons I've started this podcast is just to have an excuse to talk to interesting people and talk interesting ideas with different people. If you just ask them, bro, let's sit on a Zoom call and talk, they're not going to do it. But if you say, with a podcast, is you have a genuine reason to talk about these ideas. So I'm glad that I'm going to get back to it. Hopefully release more episodes, but thank you so much, guys. Hopefully we can do catch up in the future and talk about something else. So, thank you so much.
Absolutely, man. Pleasure being here. I think likewise for me as well. It's always fun to talk about this. And a big part of it also is, you know, like when I want to speak on this, I also get to like prepare a bit and learn a lot of perspectives, right? Which I am obviously very rabbit holed in my profession. I think of things from, like you mentioned in the beginning, a very specific lens, and because I am not rewarded to think of it from many other lenses, I you know, gain a lot of benefit by thinking from it from a very specific lens, and that's what a PhD is, I guess. This gives me a nice excuse to also, of course, I've been following GPT for a while and just been, you know, ever since it came out, it's been fascinating, I've been following it, but this was a nice opportunity to kind of take a few steps back and look at it from a larger picture, I think. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks. It was really a pleasure for me as well. Okay, I got an experience of what a real podcast is, to be in one. So that was really cool. And this was really a...
Did you have a fake podcast at some point?
No, I listen to podcasts, right? So I don't know how to do this on when it's being recorded. And so it's like... Right, yeah. So you have to like really think what you're gonna say. So it's fun.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Awesome. And it's a privilege to be a guest as well. I think. Yeah. Sorry, just wanted to add.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, guys. Thank you so much, and have a good weekend.
Yes. Yeah, have a nice weekend. You too.
Yeah. You too. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Bye bye.